Hustle Law Committee is called to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Can I have a motion for the minutes from March 25th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenthal moves the minutes from March 25th. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Holberg moves that House File 2276 be re-referred to the General Register, the Safe at Home Program. There is a delete all authors DE2 amendment. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the DE2 amendment.
All in favor of getting the bill in the shape the author desires, the DE2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. To your bill as amended, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. As you might remember, last year we were trying to resolve an issue with the Safe at Home program and keeping locations of the individuals that were enrolled in this program confidential. And we enacted some legislation to have that happen, and we've run into a few operational problems, especially around land title searches, etc. So the Secretary of State's office has been working with the interested parties over the interim and really has done all the work in trying to find a solution to that. And so I have Ms. Frazier here today from the Secretary of State's office. She'll explain the problem and the changes, and we'd appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Ms. Frazier, please introduce yourself to the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And the bill before you basically makes two different sets of changes. We looked at two different issues that arose after we passed the bill. One had to do with land records, with property records in particular, and most of the bill deals with that issue. And we've been in conversations with all of the interested parties for months and months, and this is the best solution, we believe, at this time. Basically, it separates the person's name from the person's address and says that both are private but that they can't be shared together. So because in Minnesota when we have land property records, we have both a tract index where properties are listed by property. We don't want both the property and the name listed together because then you could figure out that's where the person lives. We also have a grantor grantee index where people are listed by name. And so in that case, we're allowing the name to be listed, but not the property. And in both cases, it would provide public notice that there are additional filings, but that they are not public record, or that they are not available to the public. And so we have worked with the land title folks, the recorders, all of the interested parties to figure out a solution that will work. The current law, which says that both the name and the address are private, wouldn't allow somebody to have anything listed and would have required land property records to be completely overhauled. And so that is obviously not very workable. And so everyone believes that we need to do something and that of the options we've discussed, this is the best option. We also had some general issues with counties in particular with data and having both the name and address be private. And so the bill again makes them both private but says that to the extent that government entities are already allowed to share the name, they can share the name as long as it still remains private data without sharing the address, because in most cases they don't need to do that. So I'm happy to walk through the bill in more detail. That's kind of generally what this is. I know that we may have some other people that want to testify as well.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Frazier. Questions from members? Are there other members here in attendance at committee who would like to be heard on this bill, 2276, as amended? Seeing none.
Good morning.
Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kimball Foster. I am the examiner of titles for Hennepin County. And in that capacity, I am the legal advisor to the registrar of titles in Hennepin County. The registrar and the county recorder are the recording officers for property documents in any given county. And by property documents, I'm talking about deeds, mortgages, liens. When those documents are put of record, they become notice to the public. The recorder enters them, as Ms. Frazier explained, into the indexes so that parties looking to see what what interests encumber property can determine that, locating the document in the index and then looking at the document to see what it says. These public records are relied upon by many entities, including buyers and sellers, title companies, mortgage lenders, real estate agents, contractors, and the government. The 2013 amendment requires county recorders and registrars of title to keep those documents private for program participants, safe at home program participants. But the problem with that is the documents that go into the public record but are not publicly viewable can create a cloud on the title of every property in that county. For example, if there's a lien or a mortgage that's been recorded, but it can't be viewed, it technically could involve a cloud on everybody's title. And if the title company cannot determine what interests affect land, it's likely not to issue insurance. And mortgage lenders are very unlikely to lend if they can't get title insurance on property. So as Ms. Frazier explained, since last summer, representatives of various concerned industries have been meeting with the Secretary of State's office. Those industries are the County Recorders Association, the State Bar Association, county auditors, the Minnesota Land Title Association, and we have worked our way through a number of versions of this bill in attempts to fix the 2013 requirements. And the one in front of you consists of making records private in whole or in part, but putting a public notice, making the recording of that instrument public so that a person with a legitimate interest would have a way to look at the instrument or would be able to rule out somebody else with a similar name. Under the proposal, a special real estate notice would be given to the county recorder so that we can know specifically what property is to be protected, and if it's a person with a common name, we're able to determine that that's the particular person who's in the program, not somebody with the same name. The proposal also eliminates the requirements for the requirement for county recorders to go back and to attempt to make private records that have already been recorded before the real estate notice is given to the county recorder by the participant. Those records have already been sold to public document buyers. They're already in the public domain. It doesn't make much sense to have to go back and try to make those private. Recorders would also be granted permission under the proposal before you to make those private documents public once the participant is no longer in the program or once the participant no longer has an interest in that particular piece of property. So this bill before you doesn't satisfy everybody 100%, but it was drafted with input from the various groups and after many hundreds of hours of work on it, and it appears to be a sensible improvement to the existing law towards promoting the goals of protecting the safety of victims of violence, as well as the integrity and accuracy of Minnesota's real estate records.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Kimball Foster. I'm sorry, it was
Foster.
Ms. Foster, thank you. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Foster, thanks for your testimony. I just want to make sure I understand. So you, at least speaking for Hennepin County, you are okay with the bill. You maybe see this is a work in progress. Is that fair to say that maybe in the coming years there are other modifications, but as far as you're concerned, this is as good a solution as you think you'll get from your standpoint?
Ms. Foster.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Hennepin County is officially neutral on this bill because it hasn't gone through the board. My personal opinion as the registrar is that, yes, it does exactly what you said. It's clearly we needed some improvements to the 2013 amendment. This is a vast improvement, in my opinion. It's not to say that there cannot be further improvements in the years to come as we see how this plays out. But for the time being, it's my opinion that, this is a good bill.
Any other questions for Ms. Foster? Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Foster.
Thank you. Thank you.
Anyone else who'd like to be heard on House File 2276 as amended? Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Nancy Landmark. I am here today in my capacity as co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Land Title Association. You've heard a bit from a lot of people already about what our concerns are. Just so that you have a little bit of background, the reason that the land records are so important to our industry and really to everybody in this room when it comes down to thinking about your own homes is that title is at once the ownership of real estate and at the same time it is your ability to prove your ownership of real estate. Here in Minnesota, we have relied since the founding of this state on the public real estate records to prove ownership of real estate. The bill, as passed last year, created significant issues with that, and I certainly apologize that we did not notice the bill as it was moving through the legislature to be here to talk about those last year. In my ideal world, we would go further than we did this year. We would not have the Safe at Home records law apply to the real estate records because I believe in the fidelity and the trustworthiness of those records. That being said, we are working from where we are today, and where we are today, potentially everybody's property in a county that has a safe at home participant who owns real estate is unmarketable, and that is an unacceptable situation. Thank you, Beth, and everybody at the Secretary of State's office and all of the participants. Kim Foster was not exaggerating when she said we have collectively hundreds of hours into this negotiation process. And we've come up with what, from our perspective, the land title user's perspective, a number of key improvements, foremost of which is that we are able to tell either A, that documents do not affect property that is, in fact, being examined either directly by looking at the records or by getting a verification from the Secretary of State's office. And we have some very specific conditions under which the real estate records will be affected, whereas under the bill as originally passed, it was a very broad and very sudden, expansive application. On behalf of the Land Title Association, we support these changes. But yes, to anticipate the question, we anticipate we will probably be back again next year as we continue to work with the Secretary of State's office, the bill's author, and other interested parties to find ideal solutions that will hopefully provide even greater protection to the individual's participants and greater protection to the integrity of the real estate records. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Landmark. Is there anyone who'd like to be heard on House File 2276 as amended? Anyone else? Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Susan Roth. I am here today as the president of the Minnesota County Recorders Association. I am the Ramsey County Recorder, and we speak on behalf of the amendment before you and encourage you to pass it as it is written. We have worked tirelessly and many, many hours, not only with Secretary of State members, with our members themselves, to try to address the concerns that we're also hearing from our customers, as you heard from Ms. Landmark. The unintended consequences coming out of the 2013 statute was unexpected, and I know it was unintended, and our intent was to focus our efforts on trying to make the bill better while protecting victims of violence, but trying to keep our public records public. For more than 150 years, our property records at the county level have been open to the public. We're required by many parts of statute to provide those records and access to those records all day, every day. And customers use them for a variety of purposes. To interrupt that was an important thing to do in order to keep people safe, but it is also important that people have access to prevent fraudulent conveyances, to see what is happening and be able to ascertain authenticity of documents by coming and looking at those documents. We're supporting the Delete Everything Amendment because it does incorporate our suggestions on ways to improve the process at the local level and provide counties with some options on how to do that. Our technology in place in all 87 counties is designed to ensure that the public has access to our records. The reporting process is sometimes a very quick and efficient process, which puts the image of the document out there the instant after we've appended, through technology, a recording number. And so the concern was how do at least a quarter of the counties in the state interrupt their technology process to ensure that those documents don't become public. There were concerns about how rapidly that needs to happen, and ensuring that that doesn't happen was of primary importance for counties. We appreciate the flexibility that this amendment offers to us. Finally, our members remain very concerned about what we regard as a false expectation of safety that this bill provides by interrupting the public nature of our recorded documents. There are many, many points of contact related to home purchases, home sales that occur prior to those recorded or those documents coming to our offices for recording. We purchase and expect our vendors to provide us with secure and safe systems. We are very concerned at the transformation of those systems to provide us with an opportunity to keep the data secure and ensure that people can't hack or they can't scrape or they can't somehow find a way to access data that they're looking for. And we also have to address the issue internally of what will happen, because our records are public. Somebody could come down to the county and literally search all of our records to find out where data might be suppressed in an effort to, again, identify a location, not with a name attached, but perhaps go to those locations. So we do remain concerned that our data systems may not be impenetrable, and that we plan to continue to work with the Secretary of State and with others on ways to perhaps address those post-session. But for now, we do stand in support of this amendment and encourage you to pass it.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Roth. Is there anyone else here in attendance at committee that wishes to be heard on House File 2276 as amended? One more person. Could you raise your hand, please, if you want to be heard on House File 2276 as amended, just so I know how many more people we have? I see no one. Okay, sir, you're the last testifier. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Kevin Dunleavy, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. This is not a Bar Association bill, so I'm not speaking for the Bar Association today. I'm just speaking for myself. But the previous testifiers and Julie Strother from the Secretary of State's office spent a lot of time at my office trying to work out the technical details of this bill. And I think that it's a vast improvement in the law, and there may still be areas for improvement. But our objective was to make sure that the participants in a program would be able to have priority and perfection for deeds and mortgages so that they can buy property, and that participation in a program wouldn't cause a cloud on the title for other people in the county. And I think we've accomplished that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Dunleavy. Questions, comments from members of the author or the testifiers? Seeing none, then Representative Holberg renews her motion that House File 2276 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Thank you,
Representative
Chair,
Holberg.
Committee.
Thank you, Ms. Fraser. Is Representative Nelson here? On behalf of Joanne Ward. Who? Okay, Representative Simon. House File 2912. So Simon moves that House File 2912 be referred to the General Register. There is an author's amendment labeled A1. Representative Simon, if you'd like to move the author's amendment.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the A1 amendment.
Representative Simon Wussier, one amendment in order to get the bill in the shape that he desires. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Simon, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, members, and thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a pretty simple bill that made a lot of sense to me. It basically says that if an auto dealership is a lien holder on a vehicle, they can do more than just sell the vehicle by auction. They can actually sell it by retail or wholesale. It made sense to me because they're in that business. So who better to fetch a good price for a car than someone who's in the business of selling cars? It's not like someone who's a lien holder and they're not in the business of selling that product. Here you have the folks who are in the actual business of selling it. My understanding is there's a piece on this issue. Various advocates for consumers have no problem with the bill. So that's the bill in essence, but to talk a little bit more about what it does, we've got some testifiers here who can introduce themselves.
Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association and its 385 franchise new car and truck dealers across the state. And as Senator Simon said, from time to time, they experience the unfortunate circumstance of becoming a lien holder in a vehicle for which repairs remain unpaid or one that is towed onto their lot and never recovered. As Senator Simon also said, the only way to sell and obtain a vehicle right now in which you have a possessory lien like this is through a sheriff's sale, which is a timely, expensive and process and usually results in the vehicle being sold for a fraction of its value, oftentimes back to the lien holder. This is not an ideal situation for either party, as the lien holder often expends resources on legal counsel to ensure they are meeting the requirements of the sheriff's sale, and the vehicle's owner loses an opportunity to receive any equity from a sale that garners such low prices. The bill before you establishes an alternate procedure so that a licensed dealer who is also the lien holder may sell the vehicle in the ordinary course of business after notice is provided by certified mail at least 3 weeks prior to the sale. This bill makes no other changes to the laws governing these possessory liens, and I have copies of the rest of that statute if you're interested, but the rights of detainer are left unchanged, the timelines for notification and sale remain intact, and the priorities for disbursements from the sale are left in place. Additionally, based on suggestions from legal aid, we are adding protections for the vehicle's owner that if a dealer chooses to use this method of sale, they may not pursue any additional claims against the owner of that vehicle, and that was what was in the author's amendment. And besides legal aid, we've shared this proposal with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and Newspapers Association, who do not object to it, and we are unaware of any opposition. And myself and Jim Schuchter, our general counselor at the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association, I would be happy to stand for any questions if you have them.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Backus? Oh, Representative Wortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Backus, I haven't taken a look at the bill, but does it apply to all dealer licenses or just certain dealer licenses? I know there's a lot of different dealer licenses in the state, and other folks who have maybe limited licenses might, or other kinds of licenses might want this ability also.
Ms. Backus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wortman, we do reference the definition of statute in 168, and that includes everybody who's considered a dealer.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Backus, the testifiers?
No, that's not accurate.
No. Seeing none.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you.
Think
sir, did you want to be heard on this as well?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Schuchter. I'm the staff attorney with the Auto Dealers Association. I think in response to the question, I had thought that we had just included the new and used vehicle dealers here, not other members. Yeah, subdivisions 2 and 3, that's the used vehicle dealers and the new vehicle dealers. Not the auctions, not the parts dealers, not the wholesalers. But we're the ones who are repairing vehicles, so that's the reason we did that.
Representative Wortman?
Mr. Chair, then maybe it's a question for Matt Gehring. Because in my previous job at John's Auto Parts, we repaired people's vehicles and would have greatly benefited from a provision like this of being able to sell a car directly rather than go through the sheriff. And it makes sense to me if car dealerships can do it, then entities like John's Auto Parts and people in that industry should also be able to do it. Mr. Gehring, do you know if it or
Ms. Mullen?
Ms. Mullen?
Chair and representatives, it indicates here that a dealer licensed under Section 168.27 would be the dealer that would apply to. So I'll have to look that up. But.
Chris Portman was John's Auto Parts licensed under that section?
Mr. Chair, we had a dealer's license of some kind. I don't know if it was under 168.27 or 0.26 or.
So Subdivision 2 and Subdivision 3. Subdivision 2 is new motor vehicle dealers, and Subdivision 3 is used motor vehicle dealers. So it does appear to indicate what I think.
Well, I hope that the author would be willing to work with me on an amendment to expand the reach, because it makes sense. When you're going through the sheriff's office, it just adds expense, which ultimately is to the detriment to the consumer, because then you keep more of their money when you sell a car. So we'll work on that and maybe get an amendment for the floor or wherever it's going next.
Representative Simon, are you willing to work with Representative Hortman on that?
Absolutely.
Thank you. No. Any other questions from members of the committee for the testifiers or the author? Seeing none, is there anyone from the audience that wishes to be heard on this? Seeing none, then Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 2912 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Simon and Mr. Schuster and Ms. Beckus. Okay, Representative Johnson. Representative Clark Johnson. Okay. Can I have a motion for House File 227 be referred to the General Register? Representative Paymar, would you move that? Representative Johnson's bill?
I will move that.
Okay. Representative Johnson, you have a DE1 amendment.
That's Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Is it your intention to offer that amendment?
Yes, it is.
Okay. In order to get the bill in the shape the author desires, all in favor of the DE1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Representative Johnson, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. This is an important bill, I think, for health care in rural Minnesota. The bill is one piece of a larger picture, creating a comprehensive system for treating the most deadly heart attack called STEMI, also referred to as the Widowmaker. When a STEMI strikes, a patient needs to be rapidly transported to a facility that is capable of opening up the blocked artery. Time is obviously the biggest obstacle, and that's particularly acute in rural Minnesota. In 2013, the American Heart Association secured a $6.5 million grant to fund the development of a rural STEMI system for Minnesota. They call the program Mission Lifeline. The first phase has been granting funds directly to rural ambulance services and to rural hospitals that are PCI centers in Duluth, St. Cloud, Bemidji, and Mankato. This bill addresses a crucial piece, that of quality improvement and analysis. Data is collected from the participating rural PCI centers from first medical contact through patient discharge in order to evaluate how the system is working. HF2227 creates a STEMI registry at the Department of Health to receive the data already being voluntarily collected, analyzed, and reported for quality improvement assessments. No personal health identifiers are collected, no individual case data is reported, and no single hospital is identified. No hospitals are required to participate under this bill. This is data that is already being voluntarily collected. The bill only provides for a method of analysis and reporting for a statewide picture. You'll find in your packets, I understand, a letter of support for this bill from regional EMS directors. A STEMI registry is a crucial part of the system because it shows how we are doing and where we can focus our efforts to improve. And that is HF2227 does just that. The delete all amendment is offered because the original bill language inadvertently triggered a higher fiscal note than intended. And this version accomplishes the very same thing as intended in the original version, but with a cost of $4,000. And so, and the Department of Health, I want you to know, did testify in the Senate as to the verification of that. So it's with that I present the bill. I have two folks with me. One is Mindy Cook, who works with Mission Lifeline Minnesota, and Justin Bell, who works with American Heart Association. So I believe Mindy Cook is ready to testify.
Ms. Cook, please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mindy Cook. I am a registered nurse and director of the Mission Lifeline Minnesota project. I'd like to take a minute to tell you about the Action Registry, the data collection tool that is used for the information the Department of Health will use for this bill for analysis and reporting. So just to talk about ARG, that's the abbreviation for it a little bit. It is a national cardiovascular data registry with the purpose of quality improvement. Data collected through this registry is a voluntary participation, and data is extracted from the existing medical record by each facility participating in the program. There are roughly 230 data points that are collected on each record that collect information on patient demographics, clinical variables, and outcomes that are used and to facilitate an apples-to-apples comparison across disciplines and studies utilizing the most current American Heart Association and American College of Cardiology guidelines. ACTION is the largest national QI-focused AMI, or acute heart attack, data collection registry. Privacy is maintained through this database in encrypted password-protected methods that is compliant with the current HIPAA guidelines. Data reported through the registry is reported in non-identifiable methods and is in aggregate form. In my background prior to working with the American Heart Association, I worked as a coordinator in cardiovascular care, and we utilize the registry within our hospital in multidisciplinary team meetings with emergency medical services, emergency physicians, and cardiologists to identify areas that needed improvement in the spectrum of care, from survival that starts with the onset of the event from symptoms through care at EMS and referring hospitals, through care and discharge at the receiving facility that opens the artery. So just to talk a little bit about what data is collected, I believe you have a sample report in the packet of information that you have in your handouts today. This sample report is gives you an idea of how the data is reported and how it would be used through the state. Are there any questions?
Any questions for Ms. Cook? There are none so far, Ms. Cook. Thank you for your testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Did Mr. Bell, did you want to testify to this too, or are you okay? Just for answering questions?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other questions from members of the committee about the bill as amended? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to be heard on House File 2227 as amended? Here's your explanation and testimony was very thorough, Ms. Cook. Thank you for that. So there being none, then Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 2227 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Representative Swiedzinski. Can I have a motion for Representative Swiedzinski's House File 2989 be referred to the General Register?
I would like to make that motion.
Representative Scott makes the motion. Representative Swiedzinski, you have an A1 amendment. Is it your intention to offer that?
Yes, it is, Chair Lesh.
Okay. All in favor of the A1 amendment in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. To your bill as amended, Representative Swiedzinski.
Thank you, Chair and members. What we have before us is House File 2989. This bill is the 2014 OSS Technical Services Bill. It corrects some defects in certain business laws, eliminates redundant filing, eliminates a fee charged to another state agency, and changes the provision of the law on central notification for farm liens to accommodate some modern methods. So it's email and resolve issues related to some of the electronic communications that takes place. I've got Bert Black here with the OSS to kind of talk a little bit more about the bill and appreciate your support. Thanks.
Mr. Black, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Bert Black, and I'm the legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State. And I simply want to underline that we have worked with the stakeholders on these provisions. We've reviewed these provisions with the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, Farm Credit Services, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Revenue, the Minnesota State Bar Association, leading practitioners in the area of central notification system and farm product liens, the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association and their associates, the cooperative network, and these provisions are either supported by or are okay with in terms of not opposed by all these groups. I'd be glad to, I don't want to take up your time going through the section by section unless people desire that, and so I'll stand for any questions.
Is there a burning desire to go through this bill section by section? I don't see it, Mr. Black, so thank you, but there may be questions that members have. Are questions members have of House File 2989 as amended? Is there anyone from the audience who wishes to be heard on the proposed House File 2989 as amended? Seeing none, that appears there are no questions and you've done your work thoroughly. So Representative Scott renews her motion that House File 2989 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. Thank you, Mr. Black. Okay, Representative Nelson is here to present on Representative Joanne Ward's 2405. Representative Thank Nelson.
You. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess since something came up and Representative Ward couldn't be here, so I was asked to pinch hit. And
Representative Nelson, 1 second. I need a motion for House File 2405 that it be referred to the General Register.
Make that motion.
Representative Neuberger moves it. And you have a delete all amendment, Representative Nelson?
That's my understanding, yes.
It's your intention to offer that?
Yes.
Okay. And in order to get the bill in the shape, Chair moves the DE1 amendment. In order to get the bill in the shape the author desires, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. To your bill as amended, then, Representative to Representative
Mr. Chair and members, I'll let amendment. Keith Carlson, who's he's the expert on this, to testify, because I'm just pinch hitting for Ms. Ward.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Washington County is a member of our association where this issue first came to light. This bill really has been before the committee before. Previously, Rick Hodson, the assistant county attorney, had testified and educated the committee on the reason for the bill. Just very briefly, contrary to what possibly many of you believe, when a check is paid to a state or local government entity in Minnesota, that information becomes public at that point. This historically was not really an issue because as soon as that check was deposited, it was no longer in the government's possession, and a member of the public could consequently not practically ask for a copy of that check. But since what is called Check 21 was implemented by the Federal Reserve back in the mid-90s, more and more large entities, including those in both business and government, are no longer physically depositing checks with their banks. Instead, they send them a digital image and then either retain a physical copy of that check or a digital image for whatever is their document retention policy. In Washington County, a debt collector was aware of that, and they were trying to collect from an individual who was a taxpayer of Washington County. So they requested a copy of the check, and the county went through the existing data practices law, saw that there was nothing in the current law that indicated this information was private or non-public, and subsequently turned over a copy of that check after blacking out the checking account number. They realized after doing that that in reality the checking account number itself was public as well, unless they did an ad hoc a thing that they would have to respond in writing to the individual why they couldn't have it, and that thus the reason for this information. The Delete Everything Amendment really responds to issues that were brought up by Representative Holberg and and other individuals at the last meeting, and basically has the same effect. It codifies checking account numbers, has security information. The same thing that this committee and subsequently the whole legislature did last year with regards to email accounts, internet account access, geospatial information, in response to cities' concerns that a number of business entities were requesting this information where individuals had voluntarily signed up for an electronic city or county or school district newsletter. By doing that, it automatically classifies that information as public or non-private. The other issue in the original bill, Subdivision 2, which would have negated the need to provide a Tennyson warning when this now private information is turned over, has been dropped from the bill. In conversations both our organization and Washington County has had with IPAD at the Department of Administration, they indicated as long as we do not specify the exact medium of payment that's being requested, that no Tennyson warning is required, and consequently generally the exception in Subdivision 2 of the original bill is not necessary. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions for Mr. Carlson? Seeing no questions to the committee, is there anyone from the in attendance at the committee today from the public who would like to be heard on House File 2405 as amended? And I see no one. Mr. Carlson and Representative Nelson. So Representative Scott renews her motion. I'm sorry, it's Representative Neuberger renews his motion that House File 2405 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Chair, thank you, Commissioner. It's a pleasure coming before you.
Is Representative Faust here? Representative Atkins, Representative Paymar is here. Why can't we just do it this morning? What's it going to take to get the engrossed copy? Oh. Okay, members, we're waiting for Representative Faust or Representative Atkins, so talk amongst yourselves.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. I don't have anything in my packet that's offered by Representative Faust. What bill would that be?
Okay, so...
Oh, it's this informational?
Yes, it's the data provision. This is the second time so far this year that we've done a memorandum, Representative Scott, in lieu of the education policy bill. We would need to fell an entire forest to get the education policy bill here. I think it's several inches thick. So we're going to do it by memorandum, the 833 amendment.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair?
Representative Scott.
While we're having a pause here, could you tell me the status of House Bill 3282? I understand it's in the civil law in this committee's possession. Is that right?
I don't know the number of 3282. Can you describe the bill, Representative Scott?
It has to do with Indian Child Welfare, Mr. Chair. Representative Allen's bill.
To where? Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, it's going to be recalled, and it'll be referred to early child. Representative Mallory's committee.
Okay.
So it's going to be heard in judiciary today.
Mr. Scott.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. If it's sitting in this committee, how can it be heard this afternoon in Judiciary?
We would recall it on the floor this afternoon, Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, there's a clone bill.
So is this kind of the new process? Is just a clone bill so we can get them all through the community process and they can be in two places at once? Is that kind
of? Representative Scott, I don't know, and I don't know if there is any ulterior motive as you're describing here. I have no idea. So maybe it might be worthwhile to find out and have an offline discussion with Representative Allen about this, at which point I can discuss it, because right now I don't know if there are any, if there's any way to try to shoehorn this in or not. I haven't heard anything about it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Faust is here for the 833 Amendment Memorandum. Members, the data provisions in the 833 amendment, Representative Faust's memorandum, is the second time this year we've been hearing these items by motion, which is allowable by the rules. And so the motion on this is to approve the substance of the data practices matters contained in the 833 amendment to House File 2397. And Chair moves that, so Representative Faust, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I will give you a little background on the bill and then talk about what this does, and hopefully that will answer your questions, and if not, then you'll have to ask more questions, I guess. But most of you have probably heard of the Kyle Herm bill, which passed, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, and it was a situation where there was a child in a school. He was a special ed student, and he was being severely mistreated by his teacher. Teacher was doing really all kinds of terrible things, locking him in closets and things like this. And so, and what happened was, it took 2 years before Kyle's parents even found out about what was going on. So some students from Concordia University wrote the bill and got somebody to carry the bill and move through the process, the bill that requiring that if this happens to a child, that the parents would be notified about this immediately and this type of thing. So this is really kind of a follow-up to that, in saying that if a teacher has been found guilty of this mistreatment, that it would be reported to the state, and the state then, if somebody applies, if a different school wants to hire that teacher, that the school would have to contact the state. The state would send out any, not just alleged, but actually found guilty of any of such mistreatment, so that the teacher that does this type of thing cannot just move on to another school and another school and another school, but that it would be, it would be reported, and the school would not be hiring that person. If there's criminal activity, that would show up in the criminal record, but this would wouldn't oftentimes rise to that level, and it's a mistreatment of the student is what it is. And so the original bill, when we introduced it this year, wasn't worded exactly the way we wanted it to be, and so that it included any alleged mistreatment, and so we had to do the amendment that would change it to only if it was actually found guilty, if the school's findings found that the teacher actually was guilty of the mistreatment. And so then there was also a small fiscal note for the department to do the work that they had to do. And so it is reporting only to the appropriate people in the schools that are looking to hire a teacher that has been found guilty of this mistreatment. Is the only people that would find out about it, and it would only be coming out of the department. So that's about it.
Thank you, Representative Faust. Questions for Representative Faust. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Faust, I'm just wondering on the licensing procedure. If a teacher is found guilty and terminated from their position for doing something like this, would they not lose their teaching license?
Representative Faust.
My understanding is that they would not lose their teaching license unless it were criminal activity. If they were found guilty of it being criminal, then they would be. But oftentimes what happens is they plea bargain down from that point so that it's not a criminal, but it would still be found guilty of the mistreatment. And so they still oftentimes, in the case of the Kyle Herm, the teacher's license was suspended, not terminated. And so it's possible at some point in time that could come back into play, and we think it's important that the next school knows that this is what happened in that situation.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Faust. During the hiring process, and the licensing process once the teacher is hired, is not a background investigation done on these teachers, or shouldn't a background investigation be required before we allow a person into the classrooms with these kids?
You're absolutely right, and there is a background check that is, I'm sorry, and there is a background check that is done, but it only collects a criminal activity. And so in this case, it isn't criminal activity, doesn't quite rise to that point. And so this is just adding another level of check to, you know, when they don't quite get to that point. And so it is actually enforcing that part of the current law.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paulus. To me, I would think if there's an issue on the licensing and there's something that was put on the person's license record, that information be looked at by somebody doing a competent background check. So it makes me wonder why that information isn't already being provided.
Representative Faust.
That's a good question, and that's what we're trying to do here.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess I had pretty much the same question as Representative Johnson. It seems like if a person has a license, and the licenses that I deal with mostly are the health licenses, but if a person has a license and they've committed what seems to be pretty bad misconduct, it should affect their license. It seems like the licensing boards would get a record of that. I'm just pretty surprised to hear that they don't, and that licensing process apparently isn't working very well. Am I misstating that, Representative Faust?
Yeah, I would say that there's just some cracks that sometimes, you know, and it depends on what the level of mistreatment is. You know, what one person would consider mistreatment, somebody else may not. And so if they're found guilty of mistreatment, then the new school can make the determination of whether this is something we want to avoid or not. But I think you're right. I think that it is falling through the cracks in some cases. For example, like I said, in the case of the Kyle Herm, which was, you know, very significant mistreatment, the person's license was just suspended, not revoked. And so it is possible at some point in time that person could move to have it reinstated, and I'm not saying it would happen, but I'm not saying that it for sure would not.
Representative Liebling? Okay. Any other questions for Representative Faust? Is there anyone from the Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just having a hard time processing this in that a person that's guilty of locking a child in a closet could even remotely be, that could just be a considered maltreatment, and the person would never lose their license. I mean, isn't this law just basically allowing that to still happen?
It's moving. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is moving towards that, not allowing that to happen. I would say that we're moving that way. Yes. Maybe not as far as we'd always like, but we're moving that direction.
Any other questions from members of the committee?
Actually, I have another one.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has Education Minnesota been in on the conversation on this drafting of this language?
I talked to Education Minnesota.
Faust.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Faust.
I did talk to Education Minnesota early on this, and their opinion was we don't want teachers doing this, moving from one school to another, any more than anybody else does.
Thank you.
Anyone from the audience who wishes to be heard on the substance of the data practices matters contained in the A33 amendment of House File 2397. Seeing none, then the chair renews his motion that the committee approve the substance of the data practices matters contained in the A33 amendment to House File 2397. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Faust. Members, we have two remaining items on the committee agenda. One, Representative Atkins, and two, Representative Paymar. Representative Paymar's bill will not be engrossed for our usage until after the floor session today, so we have to come back and deal with it. And Representative Atkins, as well as the testifiers from the Insurance Federation and Minnesota Association for Justice, anticipated that this would be this after session today. So we have a half hour left, and it appears I'm going to spring you early, unless Representative Paymar, you wanted to have an informational hearing on 3017. Okay, if you're prepared to do that, we could do that. Again, members, we do not have possession because the floor session hasn't happened. So it appears that'd be the best thing to do, and then we'll still be spring a little bit earlier, I think. Okay, so Representative Paymar? Members, this is the on-session bill for public safety, and its intent is to go to the General Register.
I just do it from here.
Go ahead, Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, I don't really have the amendment in front of me, so but I can explain why we're doing it.
And I would note, members, that the engrossed version has the data provisions of why the bill is going to be here, and Representative Paymar doesn't have that, but he can go through it as best he can right now.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, let me just give you a little history of this, why this is in the committee. This is the DPS on-session bill, and when Representative Cornish, Lesh, and Hillstrom and myself were reviewing these bills with the Office of Justice Programs, there was a provision that the department wanted removed from statute, which dealt with collecting law enforcement data on domestic violence arrests or non-arrests. And this law, I can't remember exactly when it was enacted, but I believe it was in the late 1970s, actually. It mandated law enforcement to collect certain data on arrests, non-arrests, investigative reports, and all of that money was all of that data was to be sent to the department to try to assess whether the legislature needed to do anything additional to enhance the arrest and the relationship between law enforcement and perpetrators and victims of domestic violence. What happened was is that many departments were doing this and providing this data to DPS. Many departments were short-staffed and either didn't do it. So there was inconsistency in how this was being handled statewide. At first, as I understand it and remember it, actually, is that it was very useful to some domestic abuse programs to look at that arrest data, or the non-arrest data also was very interesting because that said something about you could look at these police reports or this information and ask the question, when you have a pro-arrest policy, why wasn't an arrest made? So it was a way to help the state and individual departments evaluate the data. And over the years, I don't know if any departments are still sending the data or not, but we decided as a group that it would be wise that the original intent of this was still a good one. And in this day and age, when technology is so advanced, that this should not be burdensome on law enforcement if indeed it was agreed that they should continue to collect this important data and have it used in some capacity by the Office of Justice Programs. Am I making any sense here?
Not to me, Representative.
So I believe the amendment is to get the the commissioner will the department with law enforcement and domestic abuse programs will sit down to evaluate whether the this information still should be collected and how best to use it, really, is what it does. Okay. So there's the data privacy, the data provisions for this committee.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Paymar. And that appears without use of it. I sent the CA up to get copies of the amendment. She's returning with them now, so that may give us an ability to examine it. Take a look at that, see what you think, and if it comports with, in your opinion, Representative Paymar's description. After that, we will recess and come back at 5 o'clock in order to take up the balance of the agenda, including Representative Amar's bill here, as well as Representative Atkins' House File 3073 on insurance fraud regulations modification. So if the committee would take a moment to look at the amendment on Representative Paymars.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, I guess it was a little bit broader than I explained. So the post board would also be involved, as well as prosecutors. So basically, there's no cost to this. A DPS would convene a it wouldn't even be a working group. It would just examine the current statute, whether it should be repealed or not. We could always do that at some point if it was deemed that it was unnecessary. But I think that this information is very important to policymakers, whether it be police or prosecutors, to determine how our statutes are being followed vis-a-vis intervening in domestic assault cases. That's why it was so important to collect the data back 30 years ago, and if there's a way to continue doing it and have some meaningful analysis of it, I think we still should. But that would be up to this the Department of Public Safety and the legislature.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Any questions for Representative Paymar about the substance of the amendment which will be proposed? Representative Holberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Paymar, how does your amendment relate to Section 1 of your bill?
Okay. Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that is the provision that was recommended to be deleted in the on-session bill.
Christopher Holbert?
So let me just see here.
Go
so
ahead,
so I'm not sure actually. But that was the intent was that the department felt we weren't doing Section 1, so therefore that we should delete it.
Representative Holbert?
That just
Mr. Chair, I understand the
advisory councils.
Getting rid of the advisory council, because that was something that we dealt with on the LCPFP committee and heard testimony on that as well. But is this referencing the same report? I don't. I think Section 1 of your bill was just kind of housekeeping, and that we were getting rid of that advisory council and doing it internally with a task force appointed by the commissioner was kind of serving that role. This was that group that's been dysfunctional or not functional since I've been here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymar.
I don't think it was ever dysfunctional, Representative Holberg. It was not functional. It was not, as far as I knew, it worked quite well, but I mean there were occasionally some tensions between the department and the councils. So every issue that related to domestic violence had to go to these councils, and they haven't been in existence for 15 years. So you and I both, I think I had a bill to get rid of them because they weren't functioning. I don't know that they were dysfunctional. So the on-session bill does that. This provision is a separate section of the unsession bill that asks the department to do what's in Section 1, to analyze what was in Section 1 of the bill. If that makes sense.
Mr.
Holbert?
My question is this the same report? In other words, in the Section 1, it talks about a required report, a report required by Section 629.341. And so is this your amendment? Is it talking about the same report?
Ms. Chair?
Mr. Paymar?
Yes.
Okay.
This current law, the department would like to see it go away because it's not being used. I'm saying, we're saying, is that it should go away in its current form because it's not being used. But there was an intent, and there was a use for it at once upon a time that was valuable, and we were asking now for the department and some of these stakeholders to determine, is it valuable, and if it is valuable, can we do it in another way that can help in our statewide analysis of how law enforcement and prosecutors are intervening in these cases.
Well, Mr. Chair, so just we would probably look to see this section of law may or may not be amended in 15, depending on the results of this group that you amended.
Mr. Chair, that would be correct.
Any other questions about this provision before we take it up again at 5 o'clock? Is there anyone from the public who wishes to be heard on this provision? Okay. Seeing none others, then, committee is in recess until 5 o'clock. We're out of recess and back in session. And when last we left our hero, he was describing House File 3017. We were at that time not in possession of the bill, but we are now because the engrossment has been referred here after today's floor session. So, committee members should be in possession of the amendment for 3017, and Representative Paymar, we can now vote on the amendment. Is that correct?
Yes, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Sure, it's A1. Okay. All in favor to get the bill in the shape the author desires, all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, Representative Paymar,
Mr. Chair, members, I explained the amendment this morning. This came out of the unsession negotiations where we determined that we did not want to put this in the unsession, that we did not want to totally take this out of statute because at one time this was an important vehicle for us to gather data on the law enforcement and prosecutors intervention in domestic abuse cases. And so rather than striking the statute, we're asking the department to consult with law enforcement prosecutors and domestic abuse programs to determine and make recommendations if we still want to start collecting, if we want to still collect this kind of data, and how we might do that. And again, the purpose of this and the reason why this is important is that we make laws here at the legislature. We on arresting offenders, on prosecuting cases, we have model policies for arrest and prosecution. And you know, how do we really determine if what we're doing is successful or not? This is a way for the state, as well as for counties, cities, and independent domestic abuse programs to evaluate that with some firm data, which is something I think we need to do more of. So I don't know what will come out of this group, but that's the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I remember being at the unsession conversation over this and realizing that there was really no concrete data to be used in this area. It was kind of astounding, actually. So I'm glad, you know, some inroads are going to be made there. Representative Paymar.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Representative Paymar? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to be heard on House File 3017 as amended? Going once, going twice. Okay. Then thank you, Representative Paymar.
Thank you.
All in favor? Okay. Representative Paymar renews his motion. The House File 3017 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Paymar. Representative Atkins.
Yes, sir.
House File 3073.
Good evening.
Hello, Representative Atkins. There are multiple amendments, but I'd like you to go through the bill first, if you could, to describe it, and we'll take up the amendments after. Chair will move House File 3073 be referred to Government Operations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, this is House File 3073 was a joint product of an administered or put together by Senator Metzen, Senator Jensen, and Senator Gazelka, aimed at efforts to prevent fraud in the state of Minnesota. It gives insurers and the Commerce Commissioner, for example, considerably further or additional tools to fight fraud. Does also a couple things for consumers. A brief overview of what that entails is it provides for a $25,000 per act of insurance fraud administrative penalty by the Commissioner of Commerce. That's on top of the criminal penalties that are already in law. It offers immunity from liability for insurance support organizations that release relevant information. It tightens certain billing practices, for example, limiting it to 90 days, the time that providers have to submit bills so that they can't sit on them for additional periods beyond that. There's a couple pro-consumer items in it. It increases benefits from $250 to $500 a week for income loss benefits, a benefit that hasn't been updated in some odd four decades or so. Also increases the benefit in the event of a car accident that causes someone to die from the funeral benefit from $2,000 up to $5,000. It eliminates so-called drop-down provisions that oftentimes surprise consumers when they think they have a claim that their a spouse, a child, would be covered, and they find out that under their own coverage, it doesn't actually cover their own spouse or their own child or someone living in their household that they're related to. It establishes a task force on motor vehicle coverage verification. That's been a growing issue, unfortunately, the last several years. The aim being to improve coverage and people having coverage on their vehicles. There was an amendment that went on for a whistleblower provision and also established, Chair Hillstrom put on an amendment with respect to good faith claims that those motions occur after the case is done as opposed to during the course of the case. That's a brief overview. There's a few other minor elements, but that's a fairly thorough summary of what's contained in the bill.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. We do have three amendments. We have an A14-1015, an A4, and an A5. Who belongs to these amendments?
And, Mr. Chairman, I can speak to some of those. I know that some were filed in anticipation that they may secure support, but they've been withdrawn. For example, the A14-1015 is not being offered.
Okay.
The A4 is not being offered. The A5 is not being offered. By the way, these aren't all my amendments. They're ones just to, for the clarity of the committee. I know which ones are being offered and which ones are not.
Okay.
I believe, Mr. Chairman, that the A6 and is being offered. I'm not sure by whom. And the A7 is being offered. I'm not certain by whom, but I think it might be Representative Scott.
Okay. So, Representative Scott, which one do you have?
Actually, Mr. Chair, thank you. I have both of them.
I have an A7, an A5, and an A6. So
An A6 and an A7 are mine.
A6 and A7. Okay, let's take them in order. To the A6 amendment, Representative Scott.
Thank you. This amendment is a compromise between the Insurance Federation of Minnesota and the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. And I'm wondering if they could just come down and kind of explain what it does. Just come down and kind of explain what it does, since it was a compromise between those two entities.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The A6 amendment actually merges or combines two sections of the bill, sections 2 and 3, into one. In the current bill, there's a provision that allows the Commissioner of Commerce to have a levy a $25,000 administrative penalty against a provider that's convicted of fraud or has committed fraud, and also allows through a process
the providers to be deauthorized from being able to accept payment under no-fault auto. We've combined those two sections into one, transferred that authority in this amendment to the health licensing board for the healthcare provider. They're the regulatory organization for the healthcare providers, whereas the Department of Commerce doesn't regulate providers right now. So we combine those two things into one and move those powers over to the health boards.
Mr. Goodnow, will you be so kind as to state your name for the record?
I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. Kevin Goodnow. I'm with the Minnesota Chiropractors Association.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'll be briefer. I have met and worked with Mr. Goodnow on this language. As Representative Scott indicated, be happy to answer any questions if committee members have them. Thank you.
Questions from members? Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair, and I was going to wait to bring up this problem, but since this amendment kind of falls right into the crack in the earth here, I'm going to bring it up right now, and that is that this bill, if it deals with health licensing boards, it really should go to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, which, because we have jurisdiction over the health licensing boards, there is other stuff in the bill that goes to the health licensing boards, and I've been talking with staff about possibly taking that out to prevent the bill from having to come to my committee, which isn't meeting anymore this year. So this presents a real problem for the bill, for the progress of the bill this year, and I know the bill has another stop to make, which is room for another amendment, but you know, and I know that wasn't thought of when you guys were negotiating this, but you know, this has the very likely, big likelihood of stopping the progress of the bill. Just want to put everybody on notice. So, but I mean, the bill already obviously has things in it that could do that. But I was going to try to take out the references to the health licensing board so that the commissioner could have certain authority. And it sounds like you're doing the opposite, which actually kind of makes more sense, but not at this point in the session.
Okay, anyone want to take a swing at that? Maybe we'll just move on. Pretend nothing happened. We could certainly go back to it because, you know, now there's a big elephant in the room. Mr. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why can't the committee just meet again and take it up?
Is that a question for Representative Liebling?
Yes, Mr.
Chair. Already have.
Representative Liebling, I'm told that there aren't enough floor sessions to do the series of re-referrals, Representative Howe, that it would require to go through the process by the rules we adopted. Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I think in consultation with Mr. Goodnow and Mr. Johnson, we'd be comfortable removing that section and then not needing to go to the Health and Human Services Committee. For purposes of full disclosure, I believe it's in the Senate side, and I would imagine that they would try to protect provisions that are in the Senate side. And Representative, Madam Chair, I'd ask if you'd be so kind as to nonetheless take, in the event that that language is discussed in a conference committee or comes over from the Senate, we'd welcome your input. But in light of where we're at in the progress of the up against deadlines, I think, Madam or Ms. Chair, we'd just soon remove that section.
Okay.
Section three.
Okay. On the A6 amendment,
we just need to refer to the strong.
Well, we never actually voted on the A6 yet. She never actually moved it. She started talking about it. So we have not moved the A6. So we can move to delete Section 3 of the A6, right?
Yep.
Oh, Section 3 of the bill. Okay. I'm tracking now. Okay, so we were drawing the A6 amendment. Are we talking about the A6 amendment at all? We are. No.
Trust me. It's been a long time.
Is there a motion to remove the Section 3 of the bill? Okay. So, Representative Scott?
Yes.
Chair moves that Section 3 of the bill be deleted in light of the conversation. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Okay, so what do we have to do with the Essex Amendment? Just withdrawing? Right. Okay, so we're ending up. Okay. So, thank you. Representative Scott, you have an A7 amendment.
Mr. Chair, are we still going to delete Section 2 then? Because they combine 2 and 3? I don't know if we... Okay, we're good. So, no more A6 amendment, I guess. Yes, I'd like to move the A7 then, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Okay, speak to the... Representative Scott has moved the A7 amendment to the A7 amendment, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, yesterday in Judiciary, this is actually... This section of the bill was added, and it's a bill in and of itself that was authored by Representative Atkins, and I know he's going to speak to how it is germane to this bill, but I feel like it was not acted upon in good faith. We had senators on a bipartisan level work for months to come up with this anti-fraud bill, and then this came in and just kind of, I don't know, it just didn't seem like the right thing to do at the right time. And I feel like if this is a really good bill, and I know, you know, Representative Atkins believes in this bill, I just felt like it should travel on its own. I know I've been working, you know, offline for several months on this shared parenting and child custody issue, and I know what kind of work goes into those things and the players that you have, and I would have been really angry if someone would come in and amend our bill after we finally got peace in the valley. So I'm just asking to have that portion of the bill removed.
Representative Atkins.
Hi.
I know you're talking. She just finished, so I had to call on you.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. We do have, we'll want to come back to Section 2 of the bill momentarily just to make sure that we've fully addressed the issue raised by Representative Liebling. With respect to Section 15, Chair Billstrom moved that portion of the bill. It received support from the Judiciary Committee. And it is, I do have an individual bill that goes to that. In as much respect as I have for and regard that I have for senators, we do have the Minnesota House too. What this gets at, and I think what Representative Hillstrom spoke to yesterday, as did testifiers, is that there are situations where insurers delay or deny claims in essentially a fraudulent way, where they take advantage of consumers. This falls squarely within the context of this bill. And all it says, and what judges are finding routinely, is that the motions with respect to good faith claims are being pursued before the conclusion of the action. And what judge after judge after judge is finding is, don't bring those motions now, bring them at the end. What's currently happening is there's some insurers apparently that are bringing the motions early. The judges are saying wait till the end, and then they're having to take up the motion yet again. So it's just, according to Chair Hillstrom, it was just expending greater resources by our courts than were necessary. This simply says, doesn't change the claim itself, just says you bring it after the proceedings are concluded. And I appreciate the chance to honor previous committees' efforts, specifically one that falls within there. Not that it doesn't fall within the jurisdiction of this committee, but I wanted to note that it was Chair Hillstrom's amendment.
Any other questions from members, comments about the A7 amendment? Anyone else from the public want to be heard about the A7 amendment? Please introduce yourself for the record, sir, and be brief.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dale Thorns Joe. I'm an attorney in suburban Minneapolis. I believe in Representative Rosenthal's district. I testified yesterday regarding the history of my roughly 30 years of insurance-related litigation and the fact that I was a key participant in the original enactment of the bad faith bill in 2008. I think I have a pretty good handle on the original intent of what this legislation was all about, which was to eliminate abusive discovery efforts on bad faith prior to an ability to bring the bad faith cause of action. And so the entire procedural dynamic of this bill, as originally passed, is being undercut by this amendment because it allows discovery of the bad faith claim during the main action and not even allowing the bad faith claim to be asserted. It's the cart before the horse concept, and so it's fundamentally flawed, and therefore it makes no sense within the context of the entire bill. Now, that being said, I've had an opportunity to talk with Mr. Joel Carlson from the Minnesota Association of Justice sitting to my right, and he and I have talked about what the ills are that his plaintiff trial lawyers claim to be experiencing, and I indicated to him that I'm willing to work with him, being a representative of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association, to address what those particular ills are. It's not what's being set forth in the amendment itself, but I'm willing to work with him to be able to work at, if there is an issue, to look at language that would correct what those ills are in light of the overall purpose of the original bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson for the Association for Justice. And I've committed to Mr. Thornsjoe and others that we want to get this right. I think the difference that we have in reading the language is the change on lines 9.21 and 9.22, because now what we believe it should happen is that the motion for bad faith or for good faith or breach of good faith and breach of insurer's conduct, I keep getting the words mixed up, has to come after the trial. And so when he talks about the discovery, that discovery doesn't happen until after, as you can see on line 9.21 and 9.22, after judgment is entered. So that what we're talking about is this is a post-trial relief, and we don't want to try it. We're on the same page. We don't want to try this issue until there's been a resolution of the underlying matter. And I don't think we're actually that far apart, and I think we're committed to trying making sure that if there is a procedural glitch, because we have experienced many motions and many orders from the court and parties stipulating to staying the motion until after the underlying issue is resolved, that we can work this language out to make sure that there isn't an overburden on the court and that the process works correctly. So we're committed to working on this language to make sure that it is procedurally correct. We think it is. There's a disagreement about that, and we hope to work that out.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, Representative Scott.
Oh, thank you. Then I would withdraw the amendment if they're going to be working together to find some common ground.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Do we have an 8-5? Do we have the 8-5 amendment? Okay, well, that's right. 8-5 was withdrawn. So there being no other amendments, we have the bill as it remains as unamended. Representative Atkins, do you care to reassume your territory? Oh, oral amendment, that's right. Okay, any other questions for Representative Atkins? Well, Representative Atkins, go ahead.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was alerted by Mr. Goodnow, Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Briquetti that by virtue of not doing the A6 amendment, we throw Section 2 out of fiscal order, such that we would have a fiscal note required there. That's being solved apparently in the Senate version. But what I would suggest, and I'm looking for a thumbs up from Mr. Goodnow and Mr. Johnson, that if we were to remove Section 2, that would alleviate the problem, and they are both comfortable with that. Gentlemen, are you both comfortable with that? By a thumbs up, to Mr. Chair, if I could, I would invite from you
Chair moves Section 2 be deleted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, anything else on the bill, Representative Atkins? Otherwise, I'm going to ask members of the public if they want to be heard on the bill as amended by those two section deletions. I see no one else wants to come down and testify. Did you want to say something else, Mr. Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do have a an issue as it relates to within the jurisdiction of this committee, and when it was in judiciary yesterday, they talked about bringing up the immunity and liability issues in your committee tonight. First, I want to say we've spent a lot of time. I spent my summer vacation on insurance fraud, too. And while it is not a complete Representative Scott Peace in the Valley bill, we are working to get an agreement that everyone can support that does make improvements on combating insurance fraud, but also makes improvements for consumers with their issues as it relates to their own insurance policy. So it is a cooperative effort as much as it can be. We do fight a lot, but we're doing everything we can to get to a final product. Mr. Chair and members, if you could look at page 8, starting on line 19. An amendment was added yesterday as it relates to provider whistleblowers. Basically, a provider who would be retained or hired by an insurance company to provide information of another provider's alleged insurance fraud. And I'll leave that policy discussion and decision to the legislature, but I do have concerns about item D and E as it relates to that whistleblower protection. And I would tell you that I don't think I've ever seen immunity, blanket immunity, or protection for a whistleblower or anyone else quite written in this fashion. If you look at paragraph D on page 8, you will see that the only opportunity for someone who's aggrieved by a alleged whistleblower who has maybe making inappropriate statements or interfering with my business, I do not have under this language the right to even depose them to take their deposition. The only way they can be questioned in court is by being examined in a confidential in-camera proceeding in front of a judge. I can't imagine a civil case where you can't get information from the defendant who has caused the harm that you're alleging in your complaint. I've never seen anything quite like it, and I don't think that that is appropriate for this protection, and it is not granted to any whistleblower in other statutes that we have. Paragraph E goes further on to say that they have no liability in a civil action for libel, slander, or any other cause of action interfering with your business, interfering with your prospective advantage of the business that you've built up. They have no liability for anything that is said that may be false or improper, but for the standard of actual malice. And to prove a civil claim by the standard of actual malice, where you have knowledge and intent, I intended to do this to you, it's just not a standard that we use in civil claims. You know, we use a preponderance of an evidence on a reasonable person standard. To prove actual malice is an absolute impossibility. So it's our feeling that you could be paid as a whistleblower to provide information about your business competitors and have no ability to either depose them to find out what was said or done, or have a claim against them for when they harm your business. I don't think it does any violence to the whistleblower provision of the bill by simply removing those two sections. And if you look at our chief whistleblower law that we have in Minnesota, which is the False Claims Act in Chapter 15C, you won't find any language like this. And these are employees that are risking their livelihoods and risking their job to bring about allegations of improper billing against the government. We don't give that kind of protection even to those people. To do it in a situation where the informant is actually being paid to provide the information with no protection, we think just goes too far. And so, you know, I've talked to the proponents of this, and I don't believe that it's fixable in a way where you can have a defendant who can't be deposed in a civil case, or the level of immunity that's granted here, which is not granted to any other whistleblower. So I've just suggested and told them that I would try and have Section D and E removed because it's not needed and not necessary and is contrary to every other law that we have relative to immunities and whistleblowers. So I wanted to bring that to your attention. It was not discussed in the Judiciary Committee because I think it's appropriately in the purview of this committee. And I would be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chairman, quite frankly, when the amendment went on in the Judiciary Committee, it surprised me a little bit. I support the whistleblower provision. As far as the civil course of action or the civil elements to it in Section D and E, I don't do this area of law. But what Mr. Carlson, and by the way, I don't think you represent any chiropractors or any of that community. This is, but I share the concern. I've shared it with Ms. Campo. She's been working with me on trying to figure out where that language could be drawn so that portions could be removed. I share those same concerns that Mr. Carlson has raised, and I don't think that the Ms. Campo and Mr. Kunz, who brought this to the last committee, I don't think that they were trying to get after people's businesses in such a way that, as Mr. Carlson has described. I would be much more comfortable if Section D and E were not contained in the bill for the very reasons that were noted by Mr. Carlson, while preserving, though, the whistleblower provisions that are very much in concert or in harmony with other current whistleblower laws in Minnesota. That's my sense.
Thank you, Representative Eckes. Chair moves that lines 8.19 to 8.31 be deleted. Discussion from committee.
I think you need to go to page 9.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to testify us to before we remove
let
that?
Me check for before. Let me check and make sure I got the lines right first. What would I have to go through? Okay, Chair moves revises his motion to state that lines 8.19 through line 9.7 be deleted. Any comments from anyone in the committee? Any comments from members of the audience?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Atkins.
Just if we might, I'd like to hear from Ms. Campo or Mr. Kunz, who brought the provision, to make sure that it still is aimed at, unless they don't need to be heard.
We just got a thumbs up, right. Maybe?
Okay. You described it adequately, and I've been speaking to Mr. Carlson.
All right.
I'm fine with it. Thank you.
Thank you. I feel better now.
Okay. So the motion stands. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Anything else to the bill, Representative Atkins?
No, Mr. Chairman. It's been a long day. I appreciate your attention. I appreciate your support for the bill.
It is. Then Representative Atkins, Chair, moves that House File 3073 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Anything else? We did the minutes. Okay, members, the next meeting is Friday at 10 a.m. We have 5 bills on the calendar currently. So, see you on Friday. Committee's adjourned.